and it has extended into Africa and other parts of Asia. So it's something that is a fact of modern life. It touches Christianity on a number of points. One of the interesting figures of the last generation has been a Norwegian missionary who got interested and then devoted his life to contacts with Buddhist monks. There have been those who think that there are points of contact between Christianity and Buddhism that might lead to some kind of understanding in the future. And certainly the missionary in Buddhist lands must understand at what points it differs and where it agrees. You might question why we should go into it in our dealing with China, because the Buddhists, like the Christians, have disappeared out of China. The Buddhists were just as much driven out as the Christians were, because of things in the Buddhist system that doesn't agree with communism. The idea of the church, for instance, Buddhist monks, the organization of Buddhism, it's more like that of Christianity than anything in Confucianism. You must have been struck by references in the daily press to the role of the Buddhist monks in Vietnam, where they would burn themselves in protest against what was going on. And the political power of the Buddhist monks was sufficient to overthrow the regime of Diem in Vietnam. So these are rather pertinent and significant elements in our own modern life. Buddhism was not Chinese, and for a long time the Chinese resisted Buddhism because it was not Chinese. You'll find books where the Chinese oppose the idea that they have to go outside for any religion. They will ask the Buddhist teachers or missionaries, why do we have to import a religion into China? Why are you so more important than our great teachers and philosophers? The Chinese objected to some of the practices of the monks, with the Confucian emphasis on the body as a gift of your parents. They objected to the Buddhist practice of shaving their head. The monk always shaves his head. And Confucius' disciple, that is a travesty against the human body. They objected to the Buddhist teaching of the celibacy. Chinese always thought marrying, having children, becoming a part of the family clan was the order of nature, and to deliberately not marry, not have progeny, seemed to go against their grain. So that the Chinese were not happy about the coming of the Buddhists. They proposed the poverty, the idea that a Buddhist monk didn't have any interest in the accumulation of goods. Again, didn't fit the economic ideas of the Chinese, the emphasis on possessions and things. And the doctrine, the transmigration of the soul, struck them as being peculiar. Confucius taught that the soul was not, there was no soul. Certainly it was not immortal. And the idea that there is a soul that goes on from one body to another was repugnant to the Chinese. So We can understand why at first Buddhism was not popular in China. And yet there are those who find certain strands in Chinese religion that sort of prepared the way for Buddhism. We spoke very briefly yesterday of Taoism as an opponent of the ideas of Confucius. And Taoism did stress that there is a spirit. It's not only the body, but there is a spirit, and there is a supernatural world in which we find our own place. There is a source of being. Taoism is a way of life, but it is a way that relates us to something above ourselves. So that the idea that there is an overarching reality was already in Taoism. It found expression in that other side of Taoism, which was against the rigidity of the Confucian regulations, and which believed in a sort of a spontaneous living out the life force, the way you felt that you ought to live. I couldn't help last night, Dr. White talked about Van Gogh, that he would have made a good Taoist. He had that feeling that there is a being within you which has to find expression, that you're not bound by the conventionalities that men are. There is in human nature itself this other side, not wanting to be regulated, not wanting to be fettered by other people. Express yourself, or as the present American adage is, do your own thing. Do your own thing is express yourself, just whatever it happens to be. And extreme is, of course, that there's nothing to keep you from doing anything you want to, because it's a part of your being. Well, Buddhism has its name from Buddha, and one can, I think, start with the explanation of Buddhism by how Buddha came to be thought of by his disciples. It's one thing what the teacher himself taught, the other is how his teaching was accepted. And the Buddha, whom the Buddhists, and there are all kinds of sects of Buddhism. There are more sects in Buddhism than there are in Christianity. So that it's a little hard to know who you're talking about. You have to talk about more general things which are true of all of the Buddhists. But the Buddha who came into human life taught men that there is a way of living which can give you peace and calm. I suppose if you think of the wretched condition of the people of India, from which Buddhism came into China, you can look on Buddhism as a reaction against the hopelessness, the despair, the unreality of life. The intellectual side of Buddhism is very detailed philosophy of what life is. It's hard to get into some of these things because you can't get out of it. But I want to read here and there a few paragraphs from this source book of the religions of the East, which I find very helpful. The fundamental truths on which Buddhism is founded are psychological. Basic is the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. One, all life is inevitably sorrowful. Two, sorrow is due to craving. Three, it can only be stopped by the stopping of craving. Four, this can only be done by a course of carefully disciplined and moral conduct, culminating in the life of concentration and meditation, led by the Buddhist monk. Buddhism is, as far as this world is concerned, therefore pessimistic. Life is sad. Life is heavy. The life that we go through is, after all, pretty unhappy. It is a dark picture of life, and we'll see in a moment why it is so described. These four truths, which are the common property of all schools of Buddhist thought, are part of the what they call Dharma in Sanskrit. And we're told that Dharma is untranslatable in English. So it's pretty hard to describe something that can't be translated. But it means the doctrine, it means what you see, the phenomena, what you are taught about the phenomena, what the truth is. In a sense, you might translate or try to translate Dharma by truth. I don't know why, but it struck me that many of the things that are spoken of here as Dharma are in the Swedish word Lära, or the German word Lehre, though it isn't exactly the same in German as it is in Swedish. Lära is the teaching of what is true, and it is the doctrine, and it is that which is teaching about what life is. I'm not sure that that's a good thought, but Dharma in the Buddhist thought is what you think is true about everything that exists, the fundamental moral law of the universe. All things are composite, and as a corollary of this, all things are transient, for the composition of all aggregates is liable to change with time. Everything is put together in this world, and because everything is made up of parts, no one part stays, and life is this interchanging of parts. One composition goes into another composition, one element goes into another element. Because life is not integral or united, but is made up of so many different parts, there is this constant change. As you go out to Railroad Creek here, the stream is made up of drops of water. And yet every drop is related every moment to another drop in a different way. And life is like a stream where people, where my experiences are like this stream that goes on, constant change. Being essentially transient, they have no eternal self or soul, no abiding individuality. Nothing abides, consequently, nothing can be said to have a self or to be a soul. The threefold characterization of the nature of the world: sorrowful, transient, and soulless, is frequently repeated in Buddhist literature. For until he thoroughly understands the three characteristics of the world, man will inevitably crave for permanence in one form or another. And as this cannot, by the nature of things, be obtained, he will suffer and probably make others suffer also. You try to hold on to one of these component things. You want it to stay the way it is. You wish your home would remain in the condition it is. Next day, something different. Children grow up. Parents grow old. You want to hold on to something, but nothing remains permanent long enough to be held on to. All things in the universe may also be classified into five components. They're composed of a mixture of form and matter, sensations, perceptions, psychic dispositions or constructions, and consciousness or conscious thoughts. Those are the things that you'll find in life. And it's the relationship of these that make what at the moment appears to be true. At this moment, things have a form. Next moment, the form is changed. So really there was no substance there, except in the change. The thing that was no longer is. The process by which life continues and one thing leads to another is explained by the chain of causation or dependent origination. The root cause of the process of birth and death and rebirth is ignorance, the fundamental illusion that individuality and permanence exist, when in fact they do not. Hence there arise in the organism various psychic phenomena, including desire, followed by an attempt to appropriate things to itself. This is typified especially by sexual craving and sexual intercourse, which are the actual causes of the next links in the chain, which concludes with age and death only to be repeated again and again indefinitely. Rebirth takes place, therefore, according to laws of karma, which do not essentially differ from those of Hinduism, though they are explained rather differently. Anything you do causes something else to happen. When that happens, it causes something else. There's a chain of being that goes on. And you never find any happiness because the change is always there. No permanent entity transmigrates from body to body. And all things, including the individual, are in a state of constant flux. But each act, word, or thought leaves its traces on the collection of the five constituents which make up the phenomenal individual, and their character alters correspondingly. The things you go through leave an impress on you. You become different, you change, but what you are bears in it the result of what you have been. This process goes on throughout life, and when the material and immaterial parts of the being are separated in death, the immaterial constituents, which make up what in other systems would be called the soul, carry over the consequential effects of the deeds of the past life and obtain another body accordingly. Thus, there is no permanent soul, but nevertheless room is found for the doctrine of transmigration. Though Buddhism rejects the existence of the soul, this makes little difference in practice. In the more popular literature, Buddhism takes for granted the existence of a quasi-soul, at least, which endures indefinitely. In one place, the literature speaks of the passing of the soul from one body to another as the passage of fire to firewood. The passage of fire to firewood is like the passage of the soul to the body, from one log to another. You say the log goes out, the body is dead, yes, but the fire goes on into another log, another body, and that lives on. What you do in this life carries on, in a sense, into another life. You enter another body, you are affected by what you did in the first state, in what you become in the second state, and what you do there affects the third state. So there is this constant transmigration of life from one body to another. And because life is changeable, because there's nothing constant, nothing permanent, the only salvation is to stop this process. How are you going to stop the idea of going from body to body? It is to discipline yourself so that the things that you feel cause you pain, cause you disappointment. You discipline yourself away from those things to feel that this is not reality. And you pass gradually into nirvana. Nirvana is another word that's very hard to translate. I mentioned one translation, I believe, that it's like blowing out a lamp. the result is not that there is nothing left, there is a darkness left. In nirvana, you pass from a process of change from body to body into the essence of life, into that which is above life, that which stands behind life. All of these changeable forms that we see are illusions. This world is not real, it's imagined. Each one imagines our own world. What we see, this building, it's in our imagination. Well, someone says, it's still there even if I leave. Yes, but the other person that sees it, sees it a little differently. No two persons see it exactly the same, so it can't be exactly the same for everybody. It varies with the person who therefore constructs it in his imagination. The forms are unreal. The forms are imaginary. This is not unique to Oriental philosophy. One of the great debates in Western philosophy was just on this point. What is reality? Are general things real, or are concrete things real? That is a great debate of the scholastics of the Middle Ages. Is the chair real, or is the idea of a chair real? Is the reality in the mind, or is it in the chair? Is the world real, or is it in our ideal of the world? These are things that the human mind can't get away from asking, but for which there are no answers, or there are different answers. And as far as Buddha is concerned, the whole world is unreal. And you have to get back of the forms of life into that which is the essence of the thing, which is back into the very origin of all things. And so salvation consists in getting back into the origin of life. It was taught that Buddha himself had gone through three different manifestations. Gautama Buddha had three bodies, the body of essence, the body of bliss, and the body of magic transformation. The body of essence is the essence of things, that which is, which nobody can describe. But there is, out of this essence of things, a state of bliss where you can feel that you are one with the Oversoul. And Buddha had reached this. Things of the external world disappeared. He had found himself in this blissful state where he didn't feel and didn't know the difference between forms and things and where you have an abiding happiness. The third body was the body of the magic transformation, which is his body here on earth. And this body of magic transformation was the life of Buddha among his disciples and among the people, teaching them to get away from externals into the essence of things where they would find happiness. The ultimate body of essence manifests itself in the body of bliss. The body of bliss manifests itself in this transformation. Nirvana is the ultimate, the body of essence. To teach this kind of life, this kind of attitude toward life was the purpose of the missionaries who came out of India, went up to the Northwest, and then across into Central Asia, and then into China. And in the 4th, 5th centuries AD, well, even before, the first, second centuries after Christ, Buddhism gradually gets into China and is accepted by the Chinese people. The Chinese Confucius people, of course, opposed the teachings of Buddha on almost every point. But there was something in Buddhism that appealed to the Chinese. It gave them this spiritual world, which otherwise they didn't know, except as Taoism had prepared them. And Buddhism becomes one of the main religions of China. But there are different schools of Buddhism, and the particular form that we find in China is the so-called Lotus School. The Lotus are Tiantai teaching, and it is distinctively Chinese. I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs, if you're still with me. You can get lost anywhere along here, I know, but I hope to bring you back to reality before we're through. In this Lotus School of Buddhism, we find references to what is the difference between China and Indian, Chinese and Indian Buddhism. There are two great schools. I said there are many different sects. I read through some of these, it reminds me of all the different Masonic orders that you have. And you have about a similar kind of grandmasters of various teachings of Buddhism in China. But the two main forms are the so-called Hinayana and the Mahayana. H-I-N-A-Y-M-A. M-A-H-A-Y-A-N-A. The Hinayana school did not have the influence that the Mahayana school did in China. And the difference between the two, simply stated, is that the Hinayana, the more Indian school, thought of this salvation of the individual from the element of change and the entering into a state of nirvana where nothing in life excited you or disappointed you. Hinayana was looked upon as a selfish thing. It said only a few people could attain to this. Few select souls were able to. Through discipline, through meditation, concentration, were able to attain to Hinayana Buddhism. The Mahayana believed that the Buddha set an example in helping other people to get out of their troubles. And therefore, you shouldn't be too anxious to get into nirvana all of a sudden. You should be willing to prepare yourself and help others along the way. That would be less selfish than to yourself get away from all the troubles and anxieties and irritations of life. So the Mahayana school becomes the Chinese school with the emphasis on helping other people into this state of bliss. The Lotus School is a Mahayana sect, and I read a few verses from what is one of the poems of the Scripture of the Lotus, of the Wonderful Law, and it may help us to understand some of these things we're talking about. The Buddha appears in the world only for this one reality. Both the Shravaka vehicle and the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle are not real. And these vehicles are these differences between helping others or being in a class of those who are willing to forego sacrificing life in order to help others. For never by the small vehicle, that is the selfish type, would the Buddha save all things. The Buddha himself abides in the great vehicle, the one where you are willing to help before you yourself enter nirvana. And in accordance with the law he has attained by meditation and wisdom and the effort and ornament of virtue, he saves all beings. I have realized the supreme way. The law of the great vehicle applies to all beings. If I converted by the small vehicle, even one single human being, I should fall into stinginess and greed. Such a thing cannot be done. If men turn in faith to the Buddha who is to come will not deceive them. You should know from the very start I made a vow with the desire to enable all beings to be the same as we are. There is this missionary aspect in this form of Buddhism, helping everybody if possible, to convert all beings and enable them all to enter the path of the Buddha. Although I preach nirvana, it is not real extinction. All dharmas from the beginning are always tranquil in themselves and are devoid of appearance. When the Buddha fulfills his course, he becomes a Buddha in his next life. And there are many Buddhas. Gautama wasn't the only one. They claim that there were probably 500 Buddhas. And there is a class of bodhisattvas underneath the Buddha who are preparing themselves to become Buddhas. So Buddha is a sort of a model of all of those who can escape from life into nirvana. They've learned the law and practiced charity, or have undergone discipline and endured forbearance and humiliation, or have made serious efforts at concentration and understanding, and cultivated various kinds of blessing and wisdom. All of these people have reached the level of Buddhahood. Those people who, for the sake of the Buddha, installed images, or have had them carved, have reached the level of Buddhahood. Probably one reason you have so many Buddhas, because that in itself was an act of concentration or meditation on Buddha in making the statue that helped you on to the truth. Those who with a happy frame of mind have sung the glory of the Buddha even with a very small sound, or have worshipped, or have merely folded their hands, or have uttered one praise be to Buddha, all have reached the level of Buddhahood, about the Buddhas of the past. After they passed away from this world, they heard the law and all reached the level of Buddhahood. As to the Buddhas of the future, their number will be infinite. All those Tathagatas, Buddhas to come, will preach the law by all suitable means. All these Buddhas with an infinite number of suitable means will save all living beings and enable them to dwell in the pure wisdom of the Buddha. Among those who have heard the law, none will fail to become Buddha. All Buddhas have taken the vow, the Buddha way which I walk. I desire to enable all living beings to attain the same way with me. All the Buddhas in future ages preach hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of methods beyond number. In reality, there's only the one vehicle. All the Buddhas, past and future, know that dharmas have no self-nature, and Buddha seeds are produced by causation. Therefore, they preach the one vehicle. Penetrate this scripture. Enter into this scripture. Enter only by faith. And there is one form of the Buddhism which stresses that by faith alone can you get into this mood or attitude which saves you. There's one other element that I feel we should stress, because this is where it touches our own life, and that is the place of meditation in Buddha. In China, there was a school called the Chan School, which in Japanese is the Zen School. And this is the school that stresses meditation. Other schools stressed the idea of the intellect probing into the reality or unreality of things, that you argue your way out or sort of debate with others and come to what is the truth. Then again you have those who say, no, that isn't necessary. All you have to do is to meditate, concentrate, forget everything else, and you'll enter into this reality which is above us, this over-soul, in which all differentiation disappears. Because all forms are simply different forms of reality that change, and if you get away from the process of making different things, then you get away from this unhappiness which attaches to all this change. The meditation school, called Chan in Chinese, is better known to the West by the Japanese pronunciation Zen. As a religious practice, of course, meditation was not peculiar to Chan. It had been a standard fixture in all forms of Buddhism, whether Indian or Chinese from earliest times. Yet no other school attached the exclusive importance Chan did to meditation, not only as a method or means for intuiting ultimate truth, but indeed as an end in itself, as the truth realized in action. Nor was any other school prepared to dispense as freely as did Chan with scriptural studies or philosophical discussion in favor of a purely intuitive approach to enlightenment. Therefore, where the names of other schools bespoke their scriptural authority, the lotus or flower garland sects, or their metaphysical position, consciousness only, or dharma character sect, Chan's derived from its meditative posture. From its distaste for book learning, Chan became known as the doctrine not founded on words or scriptures. It was rather a teaching transmitted from one teacher to another. Chan teaches directly pointing the human mind and becoming a Buddha just as you are, believing that the Buddha nature is inherent in all human beings. We're all Buddhas, or there's something of Buddha in all of us. And that through meditative introspection, this nature can readily be seen. By the Buddha nature is meant the Buddha mind in its highest attributes and true essence, which transcends all distinctions of object and subject or duality of any kind. It is emptiness. And this is a term, of course, you find all through Buddhism, emptiness. That is, empty of any specific character. It's not that there's nothing there, but if the lamp goes out and you have darkness, the darkness is there. So it doesn't lead to extinction, but to a different form of being. The world of appearance, with all its specific characters, is but a product of the imagination. To penetrate the Buddha mind, the great meditation masters variously advocated absence of thought, in the sense that the mind should be free from the influence of the external world. They taught ignoring one's feelings so as to eliminate all defilements and attachments. They also taught letting the mind take its course, unhindered among phenomena, the latter being, after all, manifestations of the Buddha mind. Whatever the approach, the fundamental method has been meditation. And meditation is to concentrate on some central being by which all other things fade away from you, to bring the mind into sharp focus and to make it alert so that it can immediately intuit truth, which is everywhere. The mind must be emancipated from old habits, prejudices, restrictive thought processes, and even ordinary thought itself. The horizon must be lifted, the perspective broadened, and the aim always directed toward ultimate truth. It goes on with all the different methods that are advocated, how you can do this. In one place, uses the analogy that if you're out in the woods and you meet someone with a knife that is going to plunge it into you, you immediately concentrate on how to escape. Everything else disappears. Your concentration on that one thing leads you to a form of being where the rest of the world doesn't mean anything. Well, in meditation, you forget everything. You sink yourself into the depths of being. You lose the variety and differentiation that causes change, that causes misery in the world, and you enter into Buddhahood, into this state of bliss. I shouldn't go farther because I'm sure that you've got enough to confuse you. But this is the kind of thing that came into China through Buddha and appealed to thousands of Chinese, so that Buddha became, next to Confucius, the great teacher of China. The communists saw in Buddha about the same kind of a enemy as they saw in Christianity. Here was a group that had foreign connections, for one thing, and was the means by which you could get in contact with the other peoples. It was organized through its monasteries and the monks, and as far as we can tell, it was eradicated entirely from China. Which wouldn't mean that it's gone, because Buddhism is such an individual thing that there could be many people who still are Buddhists that are able to hide it behind conformity to the communist government. I did mention that this is something that affects us even today. Someone in this course last week mentioned she had a daughter who was very much interested in this meditation business that is popular among youth today. We have these gurus coming from abroad who get gatherings or followings here. They're going to teach them the truth. You see where it comes from. A lot of it is simply charlatanism and fakery. And certainly these gurus who come here come for the money, though one of the principal things of Buddhism is you have no love for money, and consequently shouldn't have any fame or prestige or wealth. It is an ascetic form of the life, and in that sense ties in with something of the reaction we're experiencing today against the materialism of our own culture. The young people feel we've gone too far in the worship of things, and that there must be something in the mind that is deeper and more important, and they're willing to follow those who can help them to contemplate what is the truth. Well, there must be some question you have. I'd be glad to take a few minutes to...
I was wondering, this moving from, or migrating from one stage to another, does a person, according to their philosophy, ever get worse?
Yes, if you have led a bad life here, that affects your next embodiment, and you suffer the results of it.
So it's not just for everyone, constant
improvement. No, it's not improvement, it's a change. There would be no improvement. The only improvement is to get out of the process. And each one of them is a miserable being, or form of being, but the consequences of your bad life in this world is are found in the embodiment that comes to you next, and you can get out of it only by a discipline by which you improve your life so that the next migration you would take a step up. But as long as you keep migrating from one to another, you're never found nirvana. Salvation consists in breaking the migration entirely and getting away from these changing forms into an unchanging state of bliss.
Where did the idea of a soul come
from? Well, it's in all human beings. The Indians talked about great being, or the...
Is there anything in scripture that talks about the soul?
Well, I was going to say that every religion has some idea of soul, and the over-soul, the God. Certainly Christianity teaches the creation of the soul by an over-soul. God is soul. God is spirit, which is a definition we learned in our catechism years ago. God is the great spirit who has created the human spirit. So that Christianity definitely has the teaching of a soul. And I suppose why every people is interested in this is at the point of death. When a person dies, what dies? There are those who say when the body dies, that's the end. That was Confucius' thought. Body and soul, as far as there is a soul, die together. But most primitive peoples have believed that there is something that survives death. In China, the ancestor worship was based on the idea that when your father or grandfather died, the spirit still lived on. You offered sacrifices to them. You brought food to them in case they needed. You kept in touch with them. There was still this spiritual world. You'll find it in the old Greek world. It's universal. It's a part of human life, that there is something in life which doesn't die. And Buddhism has grasped this truth that the ultimate thing is not death, but life. And I think you must have seen as we've proceeded here that there are points here which are very close to Christianity in the teaching of the spiritual life, the relation of the spirit to that which is above us. It certainly doesn't cause me to lose any faith in our Christian faith. Rather, it shows how Christianity meets the kind of life we have, not by denying it, not by calling it unreal or illusion, but by a cross that enables us to bear the burdens of life so that there is a discipline by which the child of God rises into a higher state of existence. It's at this point I find the greatest distinction between Buddhism and Christianity. How do you meet sorrow? How do you meet death? Not by denying reality, but by meeting reality. What is real? Each one of us has to answer that question ultimately.
There's, and you're talking about concept of constant change in Buddhism, is it? Well, that's quite a prominent idea in our modern life. The only thing permanent is change idea.
What was the title of Walter Lippmann's book a few years ago? World is King.
The only permanent thing is change.
Everything is changing. Change is permanent. Change is life. And everything is transitory.
Well, the idea of having any material not being a reality, well, that's a part of our schools of philosophy termed idealism, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where everything, that nothing really exists except in the mind.
Well, we're getting into a deep scholastic debate, which... I'll have to try to avoid.
So that is the materialism.
Yes.
And the compromise between the two is dualism, isn't it?
Well, certainly there is in communism. and in a good deal of Americanism, a belief only in materialism. The only thing that matters is the things that I can touch and get a hold of and possess. Yes, these are the realities. The other is a matter of faith, that there is something else than matter, that there is a spiritual realm, that there are virtues, that there are laws, that there is a will that is different from the jungle, that this is a matter of faith. Though even the belief in the creation of material things is a belief. Sometimes you get the idea that Christianity is faith is over against the knowledge of science. Scientists themselves today say that science has as much faith as Christianity. I mean, it's based on faith in certain laws. When they build one of these atomic smashing things in your neighborhood, believe me, there's a lot of faith there. And faith that in the laws by which they build it.
Faith in the accuracy of their theory.
Yes. So the scientific laws are themselves the elements of faith. All of life is faith. All of life is mystery. And the differences come in how you interpret the mystery and meet the doubts and difficulties. Well, I guess our time is up. Tomorrow I'm going to bring together various things that we've touched on here and there on Christianity in China, when it came in, how it grew, what has happened to it. We've talked about the religions of China. Christianity was one of the religions, so a very small part of it. And I want to summarize what has happened to our missions in China up to the present as far as we are able to. Tell. Thank you.
Thank you.